Welcome to Below the Surface, brought to you by ADSC, the International Association of Foundation Drilling. Hosted today by ADSC Technical Director, Peggy Haggerty Duffy.
In the United States, most of us spend a lot of time on the roads. Sometimes we might think about who takes care of those roads. We talk about departments of transportation, and some of us are vaguely aware of the Federal Highway Administration. But what do these agencies actually do? Well, to give you a little bit of background, the Office of Road Inquiry, part of the federal government of the U.S., was formed in 1893. Now, at that time, a bicycle craze had gripped the country, and passable roads were needed to accommodate the relatively rudimentary bikes of the time. As a matter of fact, some form of road was needed because most of the roads in the United States at the time were crude roads that maybe had even originated as what you might have called a game trail or a trail that animals used to find food or water. Horses can navigate these roads, certainly, but bicycles, not so much. And even carts might have trouble if they tried to navigate a poor road. Shortly after the Office of Road Inquiry began, some innovative bicycle mechanics developed a new technology, the gasoline-powered automobile. Now, within a few years, cars were being produced and sold commercially, and the flexibility allowed for roads to permit horses to pass was in no way okay for the type of road that would be needed for a bicycle and certainly for an automobile. So the standard for design and construction for American roads changed, and thus the office had to change. The agency evolved quickly to meet the explosive demand of citizens who wanted to take advantage and move around the broad expanse of their country. The office was changed to the Office of Public Roads in 1905, which became part of the Department of Agriculture, an organizational designation that reflected what was important to the country at the time. As the auto industry grew, the agency was changed to the Bureau of Public Roads in 1915, and then the Public Roads Administration in 1939. You can tell that growth was changing this need and the demand very quickly. The office turned into the Federal Works Agency, but was abolished in 1949 and reverted to the Bureau of Public Roads as part of the Department of Commerce, a change from the Department of Agriculture. Eventually, in 1966, the Federal Highway Administration was formed. The functions of the Bureau of Public Roads finally were transferred to the FHWA in 1967, a year later. The mission of the Federal Highway Administration is to enable and empower the strengthening of a world-class highway system that promotes safety, mobility, and economic growth, while enhancing the quality of life of all Americans. The agency officially supports state and local governments in design, construction, and maintenance of the U.S. highway system. But what does this all mean, and what does it mean from a geotechnical perspective? So, this afternoon, we are joined by Silas Nichols, Principal Geotechnical Engineer for the Federal Highway Administration. And I should mention, before we get started with Silas, that today our episode is sponsored by TEI Rock Drills, where innovation drives our powerful rock drills. TEI drills are manufactured in the United States from parts made in the United States. So they're all American. We love TEI. Silas, the geotechnical division, is it a division?
It is. We refer to ourselves as the National Geotechnical Team.
Okay.
It is a
team. Go team.
It is a portion of the Office of Bridges and Structures and the Office of Infrastructure.
Okay.
Within the Federal Highway Administration.
That's what I was getting to. So you are part of the Office of Bridges and Structures, and for people who don't know, it is one of many offices within Federal Highway. There are real estate services, National Environment,
safety technologies and all sorts of other things. That
soft side and hard side disciplines, everything that goes into the planning, design, construction, and long-term maintenance of our highway system.
Fantastic. Okay, so how long have you been in your current position?
In my current position, I think I accepted the job to headquarters in the spring of 2008, or maybe the summer of 2008. I then immediately tore an Achilles tendon. I think I got promoted to the current position, the principal, in 2011.
So is there a relationship between your Achilles tendon and this job?
So I tore my Achilles tendon, and I lost all of my hair right after I accepted these two positions. So I think the stress level was a little bit much for me.
And so you never considered, maybe I should go someplace else?
Yeah, bad omens, but we just take those in stride.
Okay, all right. So the job of the Federal Highway Administration is to advise. Are we safe to say that?
We're really an administrator of public funds. So we essentially write law. We are the keeper of the Code of Federal Regulations. We are the developers, I guess, of legislation that governs highways. We are affiliated with the state's process for governing themselves through ASHTO, the American Association of
State Highway and
transportation officials,
yes.
And so bridge specifications and all the other specification books that are developed and maintained through ASHTO are also overseen by Federal Highways. And for all intents and purposes, we are there to just make sure that any work that is done on highways using federal money is done so in accordance with the law and is done in a safe and efficient manner.
Okay, and one of your roles is to identify technological advances, or maybe technology that's working or not working?
I think for our geotechnical program, we as a team have put together really more of a mission of advancing geotechnology. So we're in the business of making sure that guidance for the design, construction, and maintaining infrastructure over its life cycle is done in a cost-effective and safe manner and with the best technology that we can actually develop or gather. So
how do you do that? So how do you find new technologies, or how do you identify something is working or not working or needs to be improved from a technological standpoint?
I think it's a broader answer than I can possibly give, but we, at the micro level, we maintain roadmaps. My office, which we call the program, so that's all of the guidance documents like the drilled shaft manual or the micropile manual, our training courses, our policy support documents, things like that, that's all program side. We have a roadmap that sort of tells us how we're going to fund our program and what our focus areas and our activities are going to look like over the next 5 years, and it allows us to sort of think out over much longer spans of time. We also maintain a research roadmap that's maintained by Jennifer Nix in our research office, and that one essentially lays out all of our research activities and research ideas to support policy development. Both roadmaps are I guess informed is the right word, by feedback. We're a small group, and so we spend a lot of time traveling to our state administrative offices, our division offices. We spend a lot of time with state departments of transportation, a lot of time with academics, and a lot of time with industry groups. So one of the reasons why ADSC sees me so often is because one of the things that we need to do is get a feel from contractors on what it is that is working, what is not working, what needs to be improved, what is bothering them at any given time that we probably need to be taking a look at a national level.
Okay. So how much of your time would you say is spent, from a percentage standpoint, making or discussing policy within your office or within your team, versus how much time you actually sit down speaking with people about technical matters?
Oh, I don't know that I have a good answer for that. So, like I said, we're a small team. There are only two geotechnical engineers in headquarters in the Federal Highway Administration. And so, you know, we've divvied up responsibilities a little bit, and we are in the business of trying to look at, for lack of a better term, we'll use the term of our strategic positioning for the team. So, how should our roadmap look? How are our focus areas adjusting? What types of things are coming out of research or coming out of other things that are going on around the country that we need to take a closer look at with respect to either pushing out new innovation, developing new things, taking in new developments that others are doing. So my time personally moves all over the place. So I do a lot of technical assistance work, a lot of consulting with states, a lot of oversight of development of manuals and training courses, training.
Right.
So, and then, you know, as my bosses ask me to be accountable for the program, for what we're doing, report backs to our leadership. So.
Okay. All right. So there's no, you wouldn't feel like there's any fixed amount of time. Oh, I've spent 50% of my time on policy and 50. Your time is basically responding to what the current needs are.
Correct. So there's a proactive amount of time that I spend on things that I know I have to do. There's a reactive amount of time that is sort of garnered by what is going on in the country at any given time. And so if you have a bridge failure or some crisis is too strong a word, but an issue in a state that rises to a national level, our time is then reactive, and we spend a lot of time doing those sorts of things. And so, you know, my office, for instance, most recently was reacting on a very large scale to the bridge collapse in Florida, the Florida International University bridge collapse.
Right.
And, you know, we've been working with the National Transportation Safety Board for over a year on that, and it has consumed a significant amount of our time. Proactive stuff, you know, our office is doing a lot of work to in rulemaking to upgrade some of our inspection standards for bridges and tunnels. So all that stuff is on the structure side. I'm not necessarily involved in it, but it just gives you a feel for how we look at proactive and reactive time, I guess.
Okay, all right. So let's talk a little bit about where, I know that this is, I'm oversimplifying a very complex question, but would it be fair to say that obviously tax money, for the most part, funds most of the activities of the federal government? In some form or fashion, because money does not appear out of the cloud.
Let's call it public money, yes.
Okay, all right. We're going to call
We are congressional appropriations.
Okay. Well, I have been involved, believe it or not, with some public interviews in the past in which members of the media have asked me about public money as if it just appeared magically in some safe or from the clouds. And you would like to think that most people understand that money has to come from somewhere, but apparently it does not. So we're going to say, in general sense, public money comes from some source. Maybe for federal highways, some of it probably comes from the gas tax.
Yeah, I mean, finance is not my game. I know very little about it. I do know that we have a gas tax that funds our trust fund. I know that we have other means by which money comes into our coffers, whether it's through individual legislative or executive acts like the American Recovery Act type stuff that that Obama signed when he was in office. The attempt at signing an infrastructure bill would be an executive action. or congressional action to put more money in. But as far as I am aware, the majority of our money comes through gas taxes and that highway trust fund.
So, and for some people who don't know, which surprises me, when I go to the gas station and put gas in my car, part of the money that I pay when I pay for my gas is what's called gas tax.
Right, and there are several gas taxes in there. There are local taxes.
Correct.
There are some states have tourism taxes. We just take the federal share.
The federal gas tax. Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's sometimes it is surprising. Some people don't realize. They think that all the money they're paying goes to Chevron or wherever the gas is coming from. Okay, so let's talk. So that's the funding. How does your work, and again, I'm speaking and you're going to hate me. You're going to be so mad at me. But how does your work and what you do when you fly somewhere or you go into your office in the morning, how does that affect the average citizen? We've discussed before, you know, I like to talk about Grandma Jean who lives in some, you know, a hypothetical place in Iowa. How does your work affect Grandma Jean?
Directly it doesn't. Indirectly, it does. I mean, I consider my role in this to be a steward. And so my job is to use the funding that I have available to me to, with our team, identify research efforts that we think would be helpful in advancing our program, identifying program needs, whether it's in writing guidance or somehow impacting specifications and design manuals in various states to try and reduce our risk exposure in a number of different areas. Almost all of it sits either in the beginning of a project, so how we get through preliminary design, site characterization, making sure that we can actually get into construction and out of construction without a lot of claims, and then on the back end, accepting product, you know, so how we actually accept, for instance, drilled shafts or micropiles, all the quality assurance that goes into that, making sure that we're doing the best that we can do to assure not only a quality product in the ground that will be there for what we consider to be the design life or the service life of the structure, but is also efficient and cost effective to our owners.
Okay. And those owners.
A lot of words there. Good Lord.
Yes. And by owners, you're talking about the states. And other
transportation
agencies. Right. We have to speak government talk here.
So, well, I mean, most everybody identifies with our state DOTs, but our municipalities within states actually wield a lot of power. So if you're, you know, the city of Los Angeles, for instance, has its own group and,
right.
You know, various counties and local affiliations that don't necessarily use a lot of federal money still use our guidance and are still overseen through state policy, which is a reflection of federal policy. So
that was perfect. Your answer, you have no idea, but that answer goes directly into my next question for you, which is, so you just described how your policy goes to the states and then perhaps directly or indirectly goes into other municipalities, other agencies. So how, in your perception, I'm not saying this as a formal federal policy, but how do you perceive your activities, your policies, then trickling down into the private sector?
I don't know how that happens. I will say that we are aware that our guidance is used a lot in the private sector. There are not a lot of federal agencies still doing a lot of widespread guidance document writing anymore. We're one of the last ones left. And we recognize that we are influencing practice in a lot of different areas, both in this country and internationally. We get requests from all over the world for our documents and requests to translate our documents all over the world. So I know that influence is there. I don't have a way to quantify it.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, I have been involved with two jobs in the past year and a half, one where I was serving as an expert witness as a geotechnical engineer, and one where there was an argument over design policy. And in both situations, federal highway manuals were used as a resource, as a, here is the standard, mm-hmm. because in a lot of these situations, when you look for, okay, what am I going to use as a standard? Am I going to use a textbook from 40 years ago? Am I going to use some private methodology or some methodology that a university came up with, when there are, you know, there are arguments, there are dissenting opinions about how good that is? The federal government wields a lot of power. So those things happen, then all of a sudden, that's just what you do.
Correct. I think the reason why I think it's hard for us to quantify is because we recognize that the minimum standard of care that the federal government sets for spending public money is a very high bar for everybody. Our risks and our sort of needs are different than other public agencies or private sector people. You wouldn't want to do the same thing on your house that I'm doing on Interstate 65 or something like that. The standards just are different.
However, if I said I was using a federal highway manual for something on my house, I could feel like this is a methodology that has been fully researched.
Absolutely.
A lot of effort has been put into making sure that what is on paper is in fact accurate and the latest information. So it's not like you're using something that is antiquated or outdated or not appropriate. It might just be, as you said, a higher standard of care.
It's a higher standard of care. It's really driven by the durability of materials, which is really how we sort of quantify a design life. So you may not need something at your house that has a 75-year design life and thus needs a corrosion standard to fit that. And so you can do different things residentially than you would do on an interstate highway. In the same respect, if you're looking at dams or nuclear power plants, their risk levels are a little bit different than ours. And as a result, the way that they actually look at design standards is a little bit different than the way that we would look at them, even though the basis for a lot of that work may still come out of some of our documents.
So in effect, a lot of the things that FHWA recommends, a kernel of that typically migrates through and then works its way into the standard of practice in the private sector. It just may be in a different format, different level.
Yeah, I mean, the design methods generally don't change all that much. It's what goes on the front and back end.
So, in general, though, some things translate over to the private sector. And I say this because, as you know, we have this conversation all the time where we talk about a methodology or a test method or something and what is being discussed by the state DOTs, what is being accepted by the, I'm sorry, I have to note in this interview that we do have the NFL playoffs on, but silent. And Silas is extremely distracted by what's going on in the game at the moment.
I am not distracted. Every time I look up, somebody's scoring a touchdown. So.
But I will have to say that the beauty of this situation is that I know when I sit in a number of committee meetings with Silas during the year, if there is a pertinent football or basketball game on, I can count on him to have it on his phone just like I do across the room. So, you know, priorities are priorities.
Yeah.
Anyway, so moving along. So we talk about all the time that you will hear about something, whether it's postgraduate shafts that are being actively discussed by Federal Highway in the states, and there is a test method and there is so on and so forth. But it's probable that in the private sector there are starting to be rumblings of what are these postgraduate drilled shafts and how do we even approach them? And so your leadership, so to speak, helps to lead that so that it is not, you know, there's not, people aren't just spinning their wheels.
Yes, postgraduate chefs as an example. Actually, it's a pretty good example to talk about how we are informed and then how we look at development and innovation and advancement of the practice. So we first got involved in postgraduate chefs because they were just starting to show up on major projects as a reaction. They were value engineering choices by very, very creative consultants and contractors. And what we didn't have was a way to help states understand not only what was going on, but how to bid these things, how to put them into contract documents. And so we went into the idea of postgraduate chefs from a research standpoint of trying to, bound the technology. We wanted to know what it was that postgrading was doing so that we could try and develop a design methodology that accommodated it, that we could develop quality control, quality assurance measures so that you could actually figure out that what you did was correct, just a better understanding of the technology. And so 2014, I think, we let our first large contract to the ADSC to help us out with understanding postgrading. And, you know, as that project moved and got to its conclusion, we found that we had a much, much better understanding of what happened from a load transfer standpoint. So how a drilled shaft actually carries its load, how that is adjusted by this concept of post-grouting. And I think once we came to understand what was going on and that we could, in fact, control it and that we could, in fact, design for it, the next question we had was, so how do you prove what actually happened down there? And so, the state of California, again, with the help of ADSC, has moved us even further along with this in looking at quality control and quality assurance measures. And really, where the practice is going to end up going is to a position where we look at post-grouting from a quality control standpoint. We think we have learned enough that we could start to see very, very significant changes in drilled shaft design and construction practice as a result of what we've learned from this research. It is, and I think it's going to happen relatively quickly. It will be, I think, as big an advancement or change in drilled shafts that we have seen on the design side probably since we started doing drilled shafts. We've had a huge advances on the construction side. Not really anything like this on the design side yet. So.
Well, that's exciting. It's a good thing. And the ADSC had a part of that. We're always happy to hear that sort of thing. Nice. So I'm going to say, and for people who think that, you know, advancements in research only happen at the university level, obviously Federal Highway is heavily involved in a lot of really significant research. So I'm going to completely oversimplify once again, which is going to drive you crazy. But I'm going to say, so if we can pare this whole thing down to an oversimplified little description, I could say we're going to go back to Grandma Jean. Grandma Jean goes to the gas station. She puts his...
Why does her name have to be Jean?
I don't know. It just came to me. Grandma Jean, believe it or not, in my head, she has a face. I can describe her outfit to you. But Grandma Jean goes to the gas station. She puts gas in her truck. Part of that money goes to the federal government. The federal government says that some of that money goes to your office. From that point, that money is used for research, for policy development, for interaction with the states. Methods improve, whether they be maintenance, construction, design, whatever you want to say. And at the end of the day, in an ideal world, if things are being done the way they're supposed to be, when the state of Iowa decides they're going to build a bridge right near where Grandma Jean goes to the farmer's market, not only does the bridge not collapse because it's safe because the methods are what they're supposed to be. So Grandma Jean can drive across the bridge. But ideally then, perhaps the state saves enough money on the design and construction of this bridge that they're able to use some additional money to pave the road that leads to the bridge, that goes to the farmer's market, that has been nasty and potholed for years.
Sure.
And in an ideal world, remember.
You do realize that there's geotechnical aspects to pavements also, so we actually deal with the roadway portion.
I understand. But if we're just getting...
And that embankment portion.
Well, we're just talking about the bridge for right now. So as an example.
And collapse is not necessarily our biggest fear. Our biggest fear is really life cycle costs associated with trying to maintain an asset. So, you talk about potholes. I would talk about bridge settlement or approach bridge settlement, so bump at the end of the bridge type problems. Rocks falling onto the road. All of these are geotechnical problems that end up costing us a lot of money. And so we spend a lot of time also looking for ways to address performance problems with walls, with bridges.
Right. Well, and the reason I bring up collapse, because obviously in your position, that is not something, you never go into a project thinking the state of Iowa is going to design a bridge that might collapse. That is never in your head.
Sure.
But I will tell you, the average bear, I can give you a really good example. I know someone, you are very familiar with the Ohio River Bridges project, mm-hmm. in the Louisville, Kentucky area. And I know a gentleman who has nothing to do with the engineering and construction fields who lives in that area and would not drive across one of the bridges for a long time because when he saw it was under construction, he saw that the bridge supports were hollow. He assumed that had been done to save money. And so he assumed that the bridge was unsafe to drive across. So I say this because as a clarification for the average member of the public who doesn't know as much as you and I do about the design world and what is allowed, there are some people who don't deal with this every day who think, well, thank goodness, part of your job is to make sure that this doesn't collapse when I drive across it. You are giving the right methods to people so that they design it so it doesn't collapse. And, you know, that assurance to the member of the average public is a good thing.
That guy should probably move to a town with no bridges.
He's very relieved now. I did explain it to him, and he drives across the bridge all the time, so not to worry. Okay, you mentioned a few minutes ago something about employees, and I do know that there are over 3,000 employees in the Federal Highway Administration. You say that there are two geotechnical people in headquarters. About how many geotechnical people are there in all of the FHWA?
29.
So as you mentioned a few minutes ago, you were talking about pavement. There is a possibility, those of us who live in the foundations world, we tend to start thinking that the foundations, when we're talking about Federal Highway Administration, we're talking about foundations, of course. And there's maybe a chance that maybe there are a whole lot more people who deal with asphalt on a daily basis than foundations in the Federal Highway Administration?
The role of a State Department of Transportation, of a highway agency, is to pave roads.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure the number is around 4 million lane miles of roads.
Right.
Those 615,000 bridges are only there so that you can pave the road.
Exactly.
Let's take a quick break with our sponsor, TEI Rock Drills.
TEI Rock Drills Incorporated is an industry-leading manufacturer of high-performance excavator drilling attachments, drilling components, and limited-access rock drill rigs. Celebrating 40 years in the industry in 2020, our unique drilling platform incorporates innovative TEI drilling technology with the construction industry's most rugged soil and rock drilling components. TEI rock drills are hard at work in soil milling, micropiling, mining, and tunneling jobs worldwide.
Every Day Counts is a state-based model for identifying and deploying proven but underused innovations to shorten the delivery process for transportation projects and to reduce congestion, enhance roadway safety, reduce project cost, and improve environmental sustainability. The program has been in place since 2011, and 2020 marks the second year of the fifth round of innovations within the agency.
So if I were to come up with an innovative pavement that you could make out of old Starbucks cups, there's a chance it might get more attention than if I were to optimize drilled shafts.
I don't know that that's true
per se,
because it's different groups of people with different pots of money.
Oh.
My money is independent of what the pavements group thinks. If we're doing competitive grant awards, then it becomes who can sell their product the best. But I just mean
there are more pavement people. So if I had did something to make the pavement people happy, that would be making more pavement. More people happy.
You should think of it more along the lines of, I want to be careful with the words, but I'm going to say them wrong anyway, that pavement is probably more important than the geotechnical aspects of pavements, and we know this because the pavements group is funded at a significantly higher amount than the geotechnical group is.
Okay, which is where I was leading with all of this. Like I said, when you work with foundations, you tend to start feeling like, oh, Federal Highway Administration, that's just about foundations. Right.
To your point about optimizing drilled shafts, I've tried, in the time that I've sat in the principal seat, I've tried to be careful about how I prioritize things that we're doing with our money. I don't think that trying to move the resistance factor of a drilled shaft from 0.7 to 0.75 is the best use of our money by just funding a whole bunch of load tests around the country. I think we have bigger issues to deal with, and I think there are better ways to get efficiency in design than me going out and paying a bunch of money for a singular load test, for instance, in Michigan. That's not what we're really in the business for. So I think the idea of optimizing drilled shafts is a much bigger picture idea that we've got to be able to sort of see around the curve and look for bigger ways to affect the efficiencies of drilled shafts. So that gets us back to this whole post-graded drilled shaft concept, or I don't even use the term post-grading anymore. I just say the optimization of drilled shaft. So I'm really more about trying to figure out ways to align the load transfer curves a little bit better so that you're picking up resistance faster in a drilled shaft, that you're actually getting a stiffer response out of the shaft, which makes it a much more efficient design. So
this isn't just some method that flaky people on the West Coast and then maybe in Texas do. This is going to have much bigger implications.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I want to talk briefly about your program, Every Day Counts.
Okay.
Now, how does this, in general terms, play out in the geotechnical division? I'm sorry, the geotechnical team.
So, Every Day Counts, EDC as we like to call it, is a agency push implementation program. It finds what we consider to be market-ready technologies and gives them the additional bump of having agency money and agency resources behind it at a much higher level than the geotechnical program. And so we're in EDC 5 now. Prior to EDC 5 and EDCs 1, 2, 3, and 4, the geotechnical program had something called geotechnically reinforced soil integrated bridge systems, GRS IBS, as its primary innovation. It was really a rapid way to build small bridges for all intents and purposes using reinforced soil structures and supporting superstructures directly on the reinforced earth. Those came to an end, and in this most recent Every Day Counts run 2005, we were able to get something in called the A-GAME, Advanced Geotechnical Methods for Exploration. And really what we're doing with this is the Everyday Counts portion of it is really about promoting underutilized technologies for better characterizing a site and reducing risk in project delivery. So we are promoting the use of comb penetrometer testing and geophysical methods, seismic and electrical resistivity. We are promoting the use of measurement while drilling and televiewers, optical and acoustical televiewers for better mapping of rock. And the idea is to help states understand how to use these tools to just do a better job of characterizing sites. And if you can do a better job of characterizing sites, we can do a much, much better job in bid documents of reducing our risk exposure in project delivery. So lower amount of claims, lower incidences of just surprise when contractors go out to do work.
So right now on your website, which I know you're not in charge of, there is a call for ideas for the next round.
How do you know I'm not involved in that?
Well, I'm assuming you don't maintain the actual website.
I don't maintain the actual website,
no. I assume you are involved in the call for ideas. So how does that, I mean, obviously it's very complicated, but in simple terms, for example, your methodology that you implemented for rapidly constructing small bridges, where did that come from? Was that from a manufacturer, a contractor? Did they just send in crayon on a piece of construction paper, here's what I think we should do? How does that work?
No, it comes from submissions. In the case of both GRS, IBS, and the A-GAME, these were internal submissions. So our research office wrote a proposal for GRS, IBS that got accepted by the Everyday Counts team, and that really is made up of the very, very high level people in all of the states around the country making decisions on what types of innovations they thought would best help their states. So GRS IBS was submitted by our research team. The A-GAME was submitted by Ben Rivers and myself, and that got accepted. And as we go into the next round, I think our intention right now as a program is to try and extend the A-GAME. So we'll write another proposal that looks to extend another 2 years the A-GAME.
And Ben is part of your team?
Ben is part of the National Geotechnical Team. He works in the Resource Center.
Okay. And so, what is the difference between you and the Resource Center?
So we have four offices where we house engineers. There is headquarters, and headquarters is the program office. We are strategic direction. And so there are two of us there. Turner Fairbank, our research office, is considered a part of headquarters, and we have two research engineers there. The Resource Center is, for I guess the easiest way to describe them, is a consultant. They are a field group of subject matter experts that are there to assist states with needs. So the three primary responsibilities are technical assistance, training, and technology deployment. And so if we have good ideas or research has developed something and we need to push implement it out, that's really what the Resource Center is there for. And then our fourth office is our federal lands offices. We have three of those. It is where the bulk of our geotechnical engineers sit. They are individual departments of transportation. So our Eastern, Central, and Western federal lands offices deliver programs for federally owned roads. So national parks, other bureaus and agencies that have federally owned roads generally will use the Federal Lands Highway Agencies as their Department of Transportation. There is a very clean line between what we call the federal land side and the federal aid side. Program Office and Resource Center sit on the federal aid side. There are currently eight of us there. The other 21 people sit in the federal lands offices.
Got it.
The federal land side is a billable DOT, and they bill to projects. We can borrow them when we need to borrow them. We generally have to pay for them like anything else.
Like everyone, yes.
And then our federal aid side is in the administration business. We're the ones that actually assist our federal offices with oversight of state projects.
Okay, and speaking of state projects, most of what we've talked about has had to do with design, construction of new projects. You mentioned before failure. How much of your role, and I don't mean from a long-term projection role or anything like that, how much, there are over 615,000 bridges in the United States.
It's probably right around 600, probably 6.
I got that.
Somewhere in the 612 to 614 right
now. I got that from your agency. Okay. I'm just telling you.
You see, it's actually kind of funny. My director used to keep the actual number posted in our office every day because it moves like 1,000 bridges a day.
It's a bunch of bridges. So you probably know that some of the contact that the average citizen has is there has been a lot of mention made in the news, in various organizations, about the poor condition of a number of the bridges that are in the United States. You might say that some of this has been sensationalized. You might say, well, some of it you don't even realize how bad it is. Obviously, 615,000 bridges-ish, it's somewhere in there. So how much do you have to do with, failures and maintenance? Is it on an, on-call basis if they ask you, hey, we had something happen?
So I want to carefully say that I am unqualified to talk about condition ratings of bridges.
Okay.
So we have a whole department of people who do
right.
that. My boss once said to me, we have a definition for an unsafe bridge, and that is closed. So
wow.
If a bridge is open, it is deemed
safe. Right.
Yes. It's kind of weird because there are a lot of reasons for why bridges would be thought to be unsafe. The popular, in my own opinion, so this is now opinion, and popular media positions are that, well, bridges were only designed to last 50 years, and the legislation for the Federal Highway Administration is much, much greater than that, so we must have a whole bunch of bridges that are past their design life. Okay, yes, that is probably true, but that doesn't make a bridge unsafe.
Right, right. Well, and so, as I said, a lot of this has been over-sensationalized.
So I'll start there from a qualification standpoint, and then I will say that the life cycle of our system of roads and bridges is essentially all of our responsibility. So we are one of the focus areas of the geotechnical program now is asset management and performance management. We are looking to provide support to the broader transportation asset management community in looking for ways to better understand performance of the system geotechnically so that we can make better holistic decisions about how we are managing our assets. So that requires us to really sort of think about serviceability as it relates to our assets, whether it's walls or slopes or embankments or subgrades. Foundations themselves are really elements of another asset, but we do still have to find ways to figure out how to understand performance of those elements, and it's really hard, as you know, because they're all buried.
Well, that's what I was just about to ask. So is this where you've talked a lot recently about your interest in buried steel and corrosion resistance? This is where this comes in, I assume.
Yeah. So corrosion of buried steel is, in my opinion, it's one of the biggest risk items that we currently have geotechnically for existing infrastructure. We don't have a way. So if you look at something like the failure of the Leo Frigo Bridge a few years back in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you could have looked at that bridge 2 hours before it failed, and there was no way for you to know that The steel piles underneath that bridge were corroded in some cases through 100% of their section.
Wow.
You wouldn't know it until it actually failed. And when it failed, it failed in collapse fashion. The pier that failed dropped 2 feet.
Right.
And the bridge was taken out of service. You know, we could look at MSC walls the same way. We could look at anchors the same way.
Right.
You know, we had a rock slide on Interstate 40 in Western North Carolina a few years back. And we were probably going to have that rock slide no matter what, but one of the things that I think struck us when we went in and looked was that there were a whole bunch of rock bolts in there that had failed. And they had failed before the rock slide.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, we have a lot of these issues that that we're having to deal with from a performance management and asset management standpoint. We're really still trying to get our arms around a lot of those things. I don't know where that's going to end, but that's going to be a...
So we want to make sure that when Grandma Jean is driving across the old bridge that is near her house, that it doesn't suddenly collapse.
Don't
act like you are taking Grandma Jean's safety.
I am not taking her safety for granted. Again, I think we're better than we give ourselves credit for, which is why if a bridge is open, it should be considered safe.
Right, right. Okay, all right, fair enough. Now, we see you around a lot. A lot of people know you. They know that you are very into sports, as I've already mentioned in this interview. Also, tell us just a little bit. You grew up in the Northeast, correct?
I grew up in southern New Hampshire, about 45 minutes north of Boston.
Southern New Hampshire, okay. And you, as I understand it, your family, they were something of minor celebrities at the time? You graced the cover of a magazine?
Well, we didn't grace the cover of a magazine. We were part of a demographic study. Well, we were the cover photo for a demographic article that was done about the state of New Hampshire when it crossed 1 million citizens.
See, there you go. You were minor celebrities at the time. okay, so how long were you in New Hampshire before you left?
So I think we got there when I was going into the sixth grade, and I left New Hampshire right after college.
Okay.
I moved to downtown Boston right after college.
So how is it that you have none of the accent?
Because I learned to talk in Dayton, Ohio.
That explains a lot. Okay, all right. Because you know the accent that I'm talking about, and we all know, and you have none of it.
I can't even fake a car or a park or a garage. I can't even fake it, right? So.
We have an upcoming episode with someone who has that accent, and it has it very strongly, so it's going to be a little challenging.
Doesn't he actually live in New Hampshire?
He does live in New Hampshire, yes. So where did you go to college?
So I am an undergraduate degree from Syracuse University, go Orange, including my little
orange.
My orange laptop folder,
right,
handmade in Madagascar.
Nice.
Antananarivo.
Nice.
I have a master's degree in geotechnical engineering from Tufts University outside of Boston, and I am an ABD at the University of Maryland in College Park.
Nice. you worked in the private sector for a little while after college, right?
I did. I was, between my bachelor's and my master's, I worked for a couple of years on some of the preliminary design contracts for the big dig for Haley and Aldridge and then GEI. Once I got done with my master's, I went to work for a small firm in the Baltimore area, doing mostly residential work. And then while I was pursuing my PhD, I did some side work with Haley and Aldridge working on the Woodrow Wilson Bridge.
Nice. So your experience at the big dig, you weren't the guy on the take who was taking all the embezzlement money and so that everything would fail?
I was unaware that there was such a thing going on.
Okay. All right. Good answer. Very good answer.
I will say, though, I think the most... I will say that probably the most interesting professional achievement of my life is that I have literally worked on the Big Dig my entire career.
Still?
Yeah. Still.
Really?
From the day I went to Haley and Aldridge, so I was just a fresh little 21-year-old, all the way through today.
So that's like 5 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm only 36.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
But I worked on it as a consultant for Haley and Aldridge. I worked on it a little bit while I was doing my master's at Tufts as an academic. I worked on it once I got to government. The only period of time where there was a lapse was when I was in Baltimore working for the small firm outside of Baltimore.
So
that was just for a couple of years.
What do you do with it today?
There are still some, I mean, we're just about done, but there were still some lingering issues after the project was finished. So most notably, we had a huge ice freezing project
right.
in order to jack a section of the I-90 tunnel underneath South Station and the railroad tracks next to the Gillette headquarters. And, you know, if you're going to freeze 140 feet of ice, it takes a long time for it to melt. And it's just now finished melting. And as it finished melting, ice takes up a significant amount more volume than water. You get huge settlements. And
how long ago was it frozen? So how long did it take them? So we're talking about how long does it take to unfreeze? How long ago was this?
So the length of time to actually thaw that section of ice that we were looking at was around 14 and a half or 15 years.
Wow.
So, It did exactly what you thought it would do. Geotechnically, it was a marvel to watch. So,
if you had 15 years to sit and watch, of course it was. Now, that is very interesting because long-term projects like that, so often people are in a role or with a company, they don't get to see long-term effects. So you've had the benefit of being able to see long-term effects.
Yeah.
So, okay, now I have more... more personal questions, which is exactly what you wanted. So, what did your dad do when you were growing up?
So, my father is a mechanical engineer, and he worked for a number of companies. When he retired as the CEO of a robotics manufacturing company outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So, robots that make cars.
So. Interesting. So not geotechnically related at all?
No.
But an engineer. So what did you learn from your dad growing up?
I think just the value of hard work. Without sounding like my life was hard in any way, I think my father has sort of instilled in me the need for me to understand that I'm going to have to do things better just to be seen as doing it the same. And so that sort of drive and sense of just continuing to try and be better is probably what I picked off from him most.
So your mom is a transplanted Southern Belle.
Sure, what's called. They're both transplanted Southern Belles.
I would not call your dad a Belle, but that's just me. I'm going to call your mom a transplanted Southern Belle. And she moved and then worked very hard to do all sorts of things to assist with your dad's position and things that went with that, correct?
Sort of. I mean, she's her.
I'm not saying she's a supporting character. I'm saying
My mother has three master's degrees.
Really? And what are they in?
They're all in forms of nursing.
Really?
Yeah. She's she is an academic at heart, but she got her start in trauma wards as a trauma nurse. And
See, you've never told me about this. I do know about all the other things related to her, but
she at the same time was raising two kids, and as my father was sort of climbing a corporate ladder at a time when, black men didn't really climb corporate ladders like that, she had to learn how to be an executive's wife also. And I think, from her, the thing I probably most learned was to always, always prepare yourself for what it is you think you're going to be.
Good for her. Good for her. It sounds like you had good examples on both sides.
Yeah.
Well, along those lines, what do you, and I'm speaking in present terms, what do you feel like the present environment is like for minorities in, I'm going to call it our field, the geotechnical field?
I think our opportunities are better than they've ever been. Whether it's blacks, people of color, not black women, the amount of diversity coming into the discipline, I think, is exceptional, and I greatly appreciate it. It's been a good thing, and I recognize that now that I am an old person, I guess, and you're an old person too, by the way.
No, I was just saying you can't be because we're the same age. So buy that.
we have different responsibilities for sort of assisting people coming in and making sure that they have a path and can see a path to success in the same way that. That I found a path to success, or in a maybe a different way, but just finding a path to success and being able to both be recruited into geotechnical engineering and then to be able to be retained there, whether it's on the construction side, on the design side, whether it's with a consultant, a contractor, a government, whatever the case may be.
So if you had said maybe we were at a 3 when you graduated from college, on a scale of 1 to 10, where are we now?
I don't know, 3.6.
That's just not very positive.
No, I don't know, 6 or 7 probably.
Okay. Right. Well, that's good to hear. I would tend to agree with that. Well, good. Well, Salas, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, thanks to TEI Rock Drills for making this possible.
Thanks, Sue.
We love TEI. And we hope that you will join us next time for our next episode.
Thank you.